This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in today. Thanks for joining us. We're on Twitter at KUOW. In the news, it looks like we have our two candidates for Seattle mayor. The primary election was really close. Jenny Durkin made it through for sure, but Carrie Moon has only a slight lead over Nikita Oliver. Well, Oliver now says she's decided not to pay for a recount, which would leave Moon with the second most votes. We're going to hear more from Nikita Oliver later this afternoon. Mayor Ed Murray is not running for re-election. The current mayor made that decision after multiple men accused him of sexually abusing them in the 1980s. Murray denies those allegations. My next guest is not satisfied with Murray serving out his term. She wants him to resign now. Mary Dispensa is with the group SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Mary, it's good to see you again. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
What was your relationship with Ed Murray before these allegations came out?
Well, Ed and I go way back, I think, to the late 80s when I was a part of a group on the East Side. We had just formed something called the East Side Network, an LGBT group for families and friends and supporters and ourselves. And at that time, Ed was, I believe, the chair of Dignity, which was a Catholic organization within the Catholic Church, especially for LGBT persons. So I became aware of Ed that way, and actually I had a great respect for Ed in that work because I had just come out, and actually in the late 80s I hadn't come out yet, but I think I had some intuition. So then, of course, in 1989, I was appointed as director of the Pastoral Life Services for the Catholic Archdiocese. So I continued to observe Ed, connect with him, and we even had him at one of our LGBT meetings on the East Side when he was running for something. He asked if he could come and do a little campaigning. We said yes. So I continued to follow him through the years, and being an out and proud lesbian and he an out and proud man, I had great appreciation and admiration for him and his leadership.
What did you think when you first heard these allegations of sexual abuse back in the 1980s?
Actually, I
wish to be clear, allegations that have just come out recently, but allegations about what happened. Allegedly happened. In
yes, I was shocked, speechless, and sad, very sad, at the prospect that possibly they could be true. And on the other hand, I'm surprised that I was shocked because understanding the journey of, and this is not meant to imply guilt, but understanding the—
As Mayor Murray denies these allegations.
Absolutely. And understanding the journey of survivors of sexual abuse, especially in their younger years, it takes years and years and years before you are brave enough to tell your truth. You carry such horrendous shame and guilt for years and years, and you'd rather just put this piece aside. In my own life, I was 52 years old when I finally said, aha, that happened to me.
Well, Mary, you've just said you don't want to imply guilt. Mayor Murray says these are completely false allegations. So why are you calling on him to resign?
Well, for me, it's impossible to set aside the fact that these are very serious accusations. And one is not just an accusation, but it is a finding of fact. The one that was just uncovered in Oregon.
The child welfare investigator.
Exactly.
This did not go through the courts. It was the investigator's opinion that this young man was telling the truth.
Right. Absolutely. And there's something called, it's a little bit like something called administrative adjudication when an agency issues an affirmative, negative injunction, or declaratory order. So this was a very factual piece of data.
Well, Mayor Murray says it's not factual. It's the investigator's opinion that his foster son seemed credible.
But this is disparaging again, just as disparaging his accusers to us, disparage a caseworker and persons who give their life to protect and serve children, and to minimize her work and the work of that institution is wrong.
What's at stake, though, as you know, Mary, is a man who proclaims his innocence has been accused. And what about the value? First of all, if these allegations are completely false, as Ed Murray says they are, would you blame him for speculating on what might motivate people to fabricate claims against him? Because he has called the motives and the credibility of his accusers into question.
Yeah, I do. I do blame him because he's basing that on very erroneous in a position in that he has said they're criminals, they have a criminal history, they live on the streets, they take drugs and alcohol, so how can they be credible? This has nothing to do with honesty, especially honesty of your life. And there are studies and research that support the fact and position that 96% of persons who come forward stating that they have been abused are true. That is a fact.
Are you saying that even if these allegations are as false as Mayor Murray claims, and Mayor Ed Murray knows them to be false, are you saying he should still resign because of the difficulty it's causing people who don't know the truth?
Absolutely. You know, I went back to find out when the allegation first hit the press, so to speak. In Seattle, it was, I believe, April 6th. So to say this is not unsettling to the community and to the city council is bizarre. This is going on 5 to 6 months now of the media having article after article after article after article. And to say business is going on as usual, which the mayor, I think the council also believes, or can go on as usual, I don't believe that. It isn't. The community is unsettled. There are various opinions. They keep going on. It's a big elephant in the room. And I think that for Ed to resign is the right thing to do, because survivors are being hurt, not all, because some of us are at different stages on our growth and our healing journey, but some others are very, very vulnerable, and issues like this continue to keep them back in that space of victim and not being believed. So survivors are continuing to be hurt, and I believe the community is also. So stepping down could lessen this turmoil that I believe is still existing. And if it were to go on for 5 more months, that's almost a year.
I'm talking with Mary Dispenza, leader of the Northwest chapter of SNAP, the Survivors Network. I talked about this with a former mayor of Seattle, Mary. Four former mayors have gotten together to say that Ed Murray should not resign. One of them is Charles Royer, and here is Charles Royer telling me this morning why it's important that Mayor Murray serve out his term to ensure an orderly transition.
We have been through transitions, all four of us, the four mayors, and we realize that one of the most important jobs of an outgoing mayor is to oversee the preparation for and the carrying out of a transition period that's really critical to the operations of the city down the road. So that was a big part of our motivation. We all benefited from the really good transitions that our predecessors put together for us. The second reason, I think, is that there are a lot of unmade beds in the city, let's put it that way, and Mayor Murray would like to get, if not completion of some really critical projects and ideas, he would like to at least get them launched in a way that they have a better chance of success. First of all, there's the budget, which comes up right now in September, and the mayor's staff has to be together and thinking and focused, and the mayor has to lead that effort with the council. The council would have some issues, I think, with a brand new mayor coming in and not having prepared the budget, but having to defend it. Thirdly, there are big projects underway. The waterfront is not the least of them. All of the transportation issues that are out there, the homeless issues that are trying to be, that the mayor is trying to resolve, the sense of urgency that I know Mayor Murray is feeling right now.
Well, let me ask about that, Mayor. Yes, there would be a transition. Mayor Murray, there's going to be a transition anyway. Mayor Murray's going to be out in, 4 months or something. We have a system for transitions, right? I mean, what is a specific harm besides trouble and extra meetings? What's a specific harm that would come to anyone because of a slightly earlier transition?
Well, in all the cases that all four of us remember, our own transitions, the former mayors, the consensus was that the mayor had to lead that. And, you know, I would feel a little strange if I were coming in as a new mayor and the old mayor, who had resigned much earlier, essentially, had to resign again abruptly, and his staff would not have a whole lot of time to adjust. And the new mayor had never been mayor before. So there's a certain amount of experience, albeit even 3.5 years, that is really vital to the mayor and the mayor's role in a transition. I don't think any one of the former mayors would argue with that. Some of them were not excited about taking a position that Mayor Murray ought to stay in office, because some of them think that maybe, you know, he should have resigned, and a couple of them. But they also recognized that the city comes first, just as Ed Murray recognized that when he said he's not going to run for re-election. So the mayor is an essential part of the transition, maybe the key part, in our opinion.
Do you believe Mayor Murray's complete denial of these sexual abuse allegations?
We didn't talk about that.
Is that a factor in your judgment as to whether the mayor ought to resign?
Well, it's not been adjudicated. So all we know is what one paper, is saying from 30 years ago.
Well, it's not just a paper, right? And the Oregon Child Protective Services investigators seemed...
I'm not even going to get into that here. That is not our purpose in writing this statement. In writing this statement, we're thinking about the city first. The mayor has already resigned, so keep that in mind. He has essentially left office early, as he put it, for the good of the city, because he can't defend himself on the one hand and run the city on the other. It's just not possible. He realized that, and I think he did a gutty and honorable thing. What are you going to do? Are four of us going to try the mayor in our own special former mayor's court? Or do we use our judgment and say, here's the important thing to focus on right now for this city, and that is the mayor has to seamlessly and with his experience and his knowledge and his commitment to the city get us through this period.
As you said, Mayor Murray's already decided, even with his denials, that this whole thing is too big a distraction. So he could also say, you know what, people who are survivors of sexual abuse, they are traumatized. And another thing I can do is to just step down so they don't have to deal with, again, the feeling, whatever's true, the feeling they have of, again, being reminded that survivors often don't get believed. How important is that to you?
My heart goes out to people who feel they've been aggrieved without even knowing whether their stories are accurate or not. They have been put through a similar ringer as has the mayor. Without any judicial or legal decisions being made in the case. I mean, a person has a right to tell his story in a civil or criminal case in the courts. But this has not happened. So it is a bad situation. Overall, there are no winners. There are no upsides, only downsides. But the upside that we saw was a steady transition of the mayor's office. And let's not miss a beat on these important issues that are coming up for the city. And I think that's what the mayor has pledged to do. I don't know how he comes to work every day, frankly, walking through those halls at City Hall and going to his office and getting down to work, but he's doing it every single day, and I admire him for that, regardless of what the case may be with regard to his guilt or innocence. It's just not something that I can deal with.
Again, that was the former mayor of Seattle, Charles Royer, speaking to me earlier this morning about the case of Ed Murray. And also in the studio with us, we're talking with the leader of the Northwest chapter of SNAP, the Survivor Network, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And Mary Dispenza, you heard Charles Royer talking on a couple of tracks. One is a person has a right to be adjudicated, a right in court. He's presumed, Mayor Murray is presumed innocent and must be.
Well,
you say.
Partly that's true. And then I believe, as a citizen, there's something called morality, and there's moral guilt and legal guilt. And much of our system at the community level and other levels does make moral decisions around issues and problems and concerns that come up to people in positions of power. It's done with accused teachers. They're taken out of the classroom until they're proved innocent or guilty. There's just different organizations such as the church sometimes removes someone from his or her position. CPS does the same. So it's not a question of waiting until someone is found guilty in a court of law. When there's enough reason, we do remove persons.
So that's different from moral guilt, which Mayor Murray has said he doesn't deserve because he denies the allegations. You're talking about precautions.
Yes.
This gets to Charles Royer's second point. You know, a school district has many teachers. The city has one mayor, and Charles Royer is saying that mayor's obligation is to the entire city. He mentioned all the things, the police, the economy, homelessness, housing prices, transportation that he's working on. And there's also the idea that there's the question, would an early resignation disrupt that work? And also, can an early resignation of a mayor, how much can it contribute to the personal work, Mary, that you and I have talked about, the personal work and probably therapy that any abuse survivor must go through themselves, regardless of what goes on in the world?
Well, you know, Charles said it's about the city. And I think that it is about the city. What kind of a city are we? And projects can go on without leaders, especially if they've done their work. And I'd like to believe that Mayor Ed Murray has done his work as a mayor, and that his council is capable of carrying out the projects that have been started. So I don't accept that argument that this would be a major disruption if Ed Murray were removed. From my standpoint, it's a major disruption right now. I'm here. We're here. It's still going on. And
how would that resignation help someone who is a survivor of sexual abuse?
It would help me. I'm a survivor, and I must say I've been unsettled for 5 months. The first, with the first exposing of this abuse as a possibility on the part of the mayor, I really struggled with, would I speak out? And survivors get frightened back into their dark places, and their voice gets silenced when someone minimizes or disparages those who do come forward. So the mayor's act to step back would at least stop for them the feeling that they will never be believed, honored, or respected. And it took me a good few weeks to decide whether I would speak out. And then I knew I had no choice because I would be doing what I had done all my life, keeping quiet and silenced about an issue that is so pervasive. I think that to treat sexual abuse as business as usual is so wrong. And to carry on the city council and pretend that it's functioning as business as usual is very, very wrong. So his stepping down from my position would be a gift to survivors to lessen the tension and stress and emotion they are feeling now and the fear of coming forward in the future.
I've been talking with Mary Dispenza, who is with the group SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Mary is the leader of the Northwest chapter of that group. We have invited Mayor Murray on to tell us his side of this issue, and we hope that happens. And Mary, thank you for coming in again. It's good to see you again. Thanks for talking through these difficult issues.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
Again, Mayor Ed Murray denies the allegations of sexual abuse. KUOW had a conversation with Jeff Simpson, the man who was Ed Murray's foster son and who alleges that Ed Murray abused him back in the 1980s. You can read that conversation and see photos at our homepage, kuow.org. Thank you for tuning in. KUOW's The Record. We're going to be right back with a bold, first-in-America experiment for Seattle's democracy. We'll tell you how it's going so far. Stay tuned. Somebody came up with the idea of salted caramel ice cream, and it worked out pretty well. There have also been places that have sold garlic ice cream. We're going to talk about the summertime delight and flavors that survive and maybe never should have seen the light of day with a couple of our favorite ice cream vendors in this town. That's coming up here in just a few minutes on The Record. We're going to talk to Molly Moon and Lois Coe from Sweet Alchemy in just a few minutes. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Big money donors have big influence in politics, and Seattle's no exception to that. So this year, the city embarked on a political experiment in public funding for elections. How did it work out? Reporter David Hyde of KUOW's politics team asked a losing candidate. Haysom Gwaile ran for Seattle City Council position 8 and didn't make it through to the general election.
To qualify for the Democracy Voucher Program for City Council position 8 and 9, you had to collect 400 signatures and a concomitant at least $10 donation from each one of these individuals.
So when I sign, I've got to give you 10 bucks.
Yeah, so what happened there is that this is a relatively new system for people. So most people understand political campaigns is either signing pieces of paper or donating money. But in this situation, we were specifically asking people to do both.
So you go to their door, say, do you support me? Then you say, can you give me the $10 and the signature so I can qualify for the voucher? And now, can you also give me the voucher? And it was just too
much.
And
to explain that in 15 seconds when you're at a stranger's door, and you're literally asking them to do a multi-step process, and a lot of people didn't have any framework for why that was important and didn't really understand that there was this preliminary step to actually using the Democracy Voucher money.
Your competitors in this race, John Grant and Teresa Mosqueda, who got through, what were they doing?
They were using the organizations that already existed. So John Grant was using the Socialist Party, and Teresa Mosqueda was using organized labor. And because both of them had organizations that were literally able to get these donations and get these signatures, they were able to qualify really quite quickly at the beginning.
So who benefited in this race, do you think, from the voucher system as it exists?
Yeah, so the people who have benefited from the Democracy Voucher Program are people who are already very well organized, who were able to mobilize their voters to give them both the donations and the signatures in an organized way. It did not benefit anyone who was a new candidate or who had not been part of a political machine or party.
How long did it take for you to ultimately qualify?
We qualified on the very last day before the primary.
The last day.
The very last day.
So what did that mean?
It meant that we got almost $20,000 and then couldn't spend it.
What's one word that you would use to describe your experience with the voucher system?
Heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. And what's heartbreaking about it is that you believe in its initial intent. You put all of your hopes into making it work. You get to the point where you qualify. And at the very end, you have one day to capitalize on the resources you've developed
You put a fair amount of your life into this, actually.
Totally.
You know, just what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, for me and my campaign manager, we would literally spend 4 or 5 hours each day trying to get this Democracy Voucher program working. It was fraught with a lot of frustration and tears and anger and trying to get people to understand how complicated this was and how much effort we were spending. And in addition, like, I'm a doctor, so I work with people who are at the end of life because I work with older age. And every day is super important and every minute is super important. And we both feel like we wasted our lives proving the Democracy Voucher program, that we could qualify for the Democracy Voucher program, instead of really making the change, which was, how do we best help people in Seattle have dignity and value?
So there is one unsatisfied customer of these democracy vouchers. My next guest wrote the initiative that established these democracy vouchers. Alan Derning of the Sightline Institute, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You just heard a losing city council candidate say that these democracy vouchers didn't help new candidates like him. They only help candidates who were already established. What do you say?
Well, it's a sad story, and I wish he'd been able to qualify for the program. It's not true that it only helped establish candidates. Teresa Mosqueda had never run for office before. She's a first-time candidate.
But she had the support of labor behind her. That's his argument.
That's right. The Democracy Voucher program is the first time anyone in the world has attempted an effort like this. And the group of us who designed it included qualification requirements, just as every other public campaign funding system in the country includes. And they typically include getting a large number of signatures and small contributions to demonstrate that you're the kind of candidate who has broad popular support, so that we're not giving public funds to sort of fringe candidates who don't have a real chance at winning.
So it wasn't designed for, as you say, fringe candidates. It was kind of designed for candidates with some level of organization and support?
Well, at least an ability to connect with voters and convince a fairly large number of them to support that individual.
For those just tuning in, Alan, remind us, why does Seattle need democracy vouchers? What's the idea?
The idea of democracy vouchers is to make it possible for candidates to run for office without a Rolodex of members of the donor class. In Seattle, before democracy vouchers, as most places around the country, candidates spend half or more of their time dialing for dollars from members of the 1%. And we wanted to make a system where candidates could run just with people power, just by talking to ordinary voters, that they could get asked for their vote and also for their coupons that could fund their campaign. It also is a system that's designed to encourage citizens to participate more in elections. Typically, Seattle elections before the democracy voucher program, you'd have 1 or 1.5% of voters giving even a penny to any candidate for office. Very low rates of contributing to campaigns. With democracy vouchers, we think we can get that number up to 10% or maybe even 15%. And when people give to campaigns, they tend to talk to their neighbors and friends about it. They tend to get more involved in the political process. We hope that it will make it possible for more people to be involved, for more candidates to run, and for candidates to run without spending most of their time talking to rich people.
Well, you just heard from a new candidate who thought he wasn't established enough to be helped, and the big money in this year's city council campaigns didn't come from democracy vouchers. It came from political action committees that are less transparent, don't have the spending caps. So what good are democracy vouchers?
You know, the Supreme Court has protected what are called independent expenditure campaigns, the political action committees that you're talking about, and made it such that cities and states can do very, very little to regulate that independent spending. It is heartbreaking, frustrating, and annoying. What democracy vouchers can do is make it possible for candidates to run a viable campaign for office without spending much of their time dialing for dollars from the 1%. Now, they still are vulnerable to attacks from these independent expenditure campaigns, but what we know is that if candidates have enough money and they're a strong enough candidate with enough endorsements and enough people power, enough other organizations that endorse them and so on, they can overcome the attacks from the independent expenditures.
In fact, what happened is one of the candidates didn't use democracy vouchers and went above the spending caps, which triggered the ability for all the candidates to transcend these spending caps.
That's right. In the
City Council,
the open City Council race, we had candidate Sarah Nelson. She was not participating in the program. The democracy voucher program is voluntary, both for voters and for candidates. And there is a provision in the law, as in every other public funding system in the country, that candidates can be released from the spending limits if their opponents go way over the limit. And the reason that we had to put that in is because no candidate is going to agree to unilaterally disarm. It's not a perfect system, but it is a Seattle-born and bred effort to make it possible for people to run for office with less dependence on one percenters.
Bottom line, Alan, you're the author of this initiative that established these first ever democracy vouchers. And if anyone lacks faith in the democracy voucher program, what is your conclusion from our experiment so far? What's your message?
Look, the independent money is a problem that the city has very little control over. We need change at the federal level and the Supreme Court or a constitutional amendment. But what we know from around the country is that independent money matters, but it's not decisive if you have strong candidates who have enough money to get their message out, right? It's not always the case that the person with the most money wins, but you have to have enough money. And that's what the Democracy Voucher Program is intended to do. It's intended to make it possible for you to run a viable campaign to get your message out. And if your message resonates with enough voters, you can win office, even without spending 4 or 5 hours a day dialing for dollars from members of the donor class. That's one of the key things that people need to focus on this, right? How candidates are spending their time is a key sign of success. If candidates are spending their time talking to ordinary voters and funding their campaign through the same activity of talking to ordinary voters about their concern and talking about their vision for the city, then it's success. What we know from particularly from state and federal elections where candidates are spending so much of their time dialing for dollars is that candidates have an intimate familiarity with the concerns of lobbyists and people who can write them the maximum size checks, because they spend so much time talking with them. They know exactly what those people think. But do they know what middle class and working class people? They probably read some polls. But they don't have that intimate first-person experience with it. And again, that's what the democracy vouchers are about. You can run for office by just talking to ordinary voters.
And by the way, that Seattle privately funded candidate lost.
It's further proof that that having the most money doesn't always guarantee victory, right? You need enough money. You don't necessarily need the most.
Alan Derning, co-author of the initiative that's brought us this experiment of democracy vouchers, will watch the whole thing proceed. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I think Twitter can come in handy here because I'd love to know as you're listening when you go to @KUOW, I'd love to hear your ideas because we just made you smart about democracy vouchers, and now we're about to have dessert. Summertime dessert.
Ice cream! Ice cream! Ice cream!
The middle of August is waffle cone time, and those flavors aren't going to create themselves. So how do they decide which ice cream flavor is going to be the next salted caramel? And which flavor is likely to show up in your Facebook feed in an article about the worst ice cream flavors of all time? Here to share ice cream stories is Molly Moon of Molly Moon's Ice Cream, of course. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. And Lois Coe of Sweet Alchemy in the University District on the Ave. Welcome, Lois.
Hello, thank you for having me.
When you tell people who you are and what you do for a living, what is the most asked question that you get, Molly Moon?
Well, if it's people from out of town, they want to know what our most popular flavor is. Mm-hmm. If it's people from Seattle, it's usually what's coming up on our seasonal menu.
Really?
Yeah.
They want to know. Do they ever ask, what's it like to be Molly Moon? Are you like Willy Wonka? Are you the happiest person on earth? That kind of stuff?
People think that. I mean, ice cream does make you happy. And I think people mostly think it's sort of joyous and Willy Wonka-ish. It's also, you know, I run a company with 200 employees, so there's some stress related to that at this point, especially at the height of summer. But it's
sure, those Oompa Loompas can be disobedient.
Yes.
So, yeah.
We call them the Moon Crew.
The Moon Crew. Very good. How about you, Lois? What do people want to know? In Seattle.
Okay. People want to know why I'm in the ice cream business, what brought me in the ice cream business, and where I'm going to be going with my single shop. That looks so cute, but yeah.
Are you going to expand and be Molly Moon's direct competitor?
Ooh, maybe. I don't see myself expanding to take over Seattle. I I really want to keep it small so I can have complete hands-on and everything. Mm. But I do want to make my single shop survivable. So we are going out and catering, and hopefully maybe we can go into the small organic and local markets, like the grocery stores. Not Whole Foods. They're too big of a beast. There's the smaller ones, like Ken's Market. Down
catering? I've never catered with ice cream. That seems like that's really got to happen right on time. That seems stressful.
You want to buy an ice cream truck?
Ooh, ice cream truck.
That's how you cater with ice cream.
Yeah,
I
bet.
It's a big endeavor.
I threw out the example of salted caramel, which started an office argument this morning. Immediately, I have colleagues who think that's a fad and history will not be kind to salted caramel. I beg to differ. What do you think? Salted caramel, would you have signed off on that?
Well, salted caramel was the most popular flavor at Molly Moon's for 8.5 years.
8.5 years.
And in the beginning of my business, which I started in 2008 in Wallingford, it was almost 30% of our total sales.
And what about now?
It has been knocked into second place by our cinnamon chocolate chip oatmeal cookie dough ice cream.
Wait a minute. Cinnamon chocolate chip
Oatmeal. Cookie dough.
I'm writing it down. Cookie dough. See, I would have thought that's too much going on in one flavor. Is there any such thing as too much going on in one ice cream flavor?
There is such a thing. This turns out to be pretty simple when you take a bite. It's a cinnamon nutmeg ice cream with oatmeal chocolate chip cookie dough in it.
That sounded simpler the second time.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Lois? What's your when you're creating flavors, do you like to go simple? Do you say the kitchen sink? What?
We start off simple, and it's usually the customers who will input and tell us that, oh, you know what, this ice cream needs a little more this in it. And I'll be like, actually, we can do that. And yeah, we only make 2 to maybe 3 tubs of a single flavor at a time. So it's really easy to bump it up and to add things into it as customers or my employees give us feedback.
What's your number one flavor?
Our number one flavor is the dark side, which is a Dutch chocolate ice cream with homemade Oreos and chocolate ganache swirls in it.
What is ganache?
Ganache is a creamed down version of a hard chocolate.
Okay, Dutch chocolate Oreo ganache. How does that sound to you, Molly? Would you do that?
Sounds delicious.
Are you going to be honest with each other? Like, would you tell each other, that sounds awful?
I would say that sounds awful. That sounds delicious. Okay. I wouldn't put Oreos in our ice cream, but I like it when other people do.
Why wouldn't you put Oreos in your ice cream?
We buy everything locally as much as possible. And then there are a few ingredients that like we feel we have to have, like chocolate.
Yeah.
And that's all fair trade and organic.
Got it. You mentioned the customers come up with ideas, Lois. Mm-hmm. We have customers at KUOW. They have ideas. On our Facebook page, Nicole says, beet, carrot, and berry citrus sorbet with walnuts. Mm-hmm. What do you think of Nicole's idea? Be honest. Nicole is going to be okay.
When I opened my Capitol Hill shop in 2009, I had a baby beet sorbet on the menu. And it...
Why baby beets?
I thought they'd be sweeter. Uh-huh. And they were. And it did not sell well, and I had a lot of it in my freezer left over.
Did people even sample it and then not buy it, or they didn't even try?
Yes, people love to sample the weird flavors, but even if they're sampling tons, you know, some of them just don't get purchased. Another failure of mine was spring garlic ice cream.
You actually tried the garlic?
Oh, yeah.
I made garlic ice cream, too.
Yeah.
Does it
people
sell?
People loved tasting it.
They love sampling
buying a
it. Yeah. That is a delicate compliment right there. And people love tasting it.
Yeah, and I think my third biggest failure was really sad because it was a really fun partnership with another local brand. Mm. But we did a Beecher's flagship cheese ice cream, which I thought was delicious with a scoop on top of apple pie, sort of a take on that cheddar cheese on apple pie tradition. But we also had a lot of that left over.
Is it the name cheese ice cream, or like, do you think if you...
People tasted it and, again, just didn't want to buy a scoop. We did sell some pints for people to go do the pie trick, but, you know, our high sales are because people stand in line for a scoop and a waffle cone.
Scoop and a waffle cone. So, Lois, Molly Moon is done with garlic, beets, and Beecher's cheese on apple pie. What about you? What has failed at Sweet Alchemy?
So our biggest failure was the garlic. It took us a long time to go through that. Our second
failure. So to go through it? You mean you had to eat all of it?
Yeah, we ended up eating a lot of it. We ended up having our employees bring pizzas in, and then we would put it on the pizza, and we would enjoy it.
Because if you put the garlic ice cream on pizza...
It tasted good. I mean, in our standards. Uh-huh. But we love weird flavors.
What about pizza ice cream?
Pizza ice cream. I feel like tomato and basil would be a good ice cream. And I think you tried a tomato ice cream, right?
We did a tomato basil sorbet. And that was not a total bust. Uh-huh. But if you're watching your bottom line, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Not waistline, your bottom line.
Yeah.
So garlic, no good. What else?
Sriracha. People love tasting it. They would come in to try it, and then they would be like, ooh, I'm not sure I can have a scoop of that.
That's a funny thing. I thought that about chocolate with, what was the pepper in it? Everybody was doing
cayenne
that.
Pepper.
The cayenne pepper in the chocolate.
Uh-huh. We have a version of that. That's
and that
amazing.
Sells.
It sells crazy.
So what is it about sriracha that doesn't work? It's not like people can't do spicy ice cream.
Maybe it needs a complement. Like maybe sriracha and chocolate would sell well, while sriracha and a plainer base doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I'm talking with Molly Moon and Lois Coe of Sweet Alchemy in the U District. And Gunner on our Facebook page is into avocado ice cream, which I enjoy. Yes, Lois?
I've done it. I've done avocado and honey. And my childhood was actually spent in South Africa. And that's avocado and honey on top of fried egg is what we ate every day for like 3 years.
Avocado ice cream or just avocado and honey on fried egg?
Honey on fried egg was breakfast, my childhood breakfast.
That sounds great.
It's very delicious. And I wanted to bring that into ice cream. The texture was really hard. It hardened up the fat, extra fat from the avocado hardened up the ice cream. And not as many people loved it as I did.
Huh. Yeah, I had a coworker say, ugh, avocado ice cream. I said, what are you talking about?
It's really popular in I've been to a few shops when I lived in San Francisco who it was an Indian or Pakistani family who had an ice cream shop. And they had a really great textured avocado ice cream, but they must have just worked on that texture for a long time.
Huh. Do you pipe out smell from your place, Molly Moon, right?
I don't actually pipe it out.
You don't?
It happens.
It just happens.
Yeah.
And it's so it's all natural. Sometimes I wonder whether people, you know, pipe out smell.
Well, we make waffle cones starting at 9 or 10 a.m. every day.
Yeah.
And so that smell is just going until we stop making them around 10. And then we also, of the 8 Molly Moon's ice cream shops, 6 of them have a full kitchen where we make all the ice cream in that neighborhood. So you're not just smelling the waffle cones. You're also smelling us, you know, melt and make homemade caramel, melt the Theo chocolate into our milk, cream, and sugar. So you're smelling a working kitchen.
Sweet Alchemy, do you pump out the smell?
We don't pump it out, but like Molly said, I mean, when we are baking our waffle cones, we put a lot of butter into it. So a lot of customers who are walking down the street would be like, are you guys making shortbread? And we're like, no, just our waffle cone. You should try it. And then we also have a full kitchen, and our bakers at our location starting at 6, 7 a.m., baking all the pastries and all the Oreos and all the brownies that go into our ice cream. And that smells amazing in and of itself.
Talking about a summertime delight, on Facebook, Marty says, one of my favorite flavors from the UK, rhubarb and custard. Now, I don't know what flavor the custard would be. Custard is egg and sugar and milk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sound good? Rhubarb?
We always do a rhubarb, a few rhubarb flavors in the spring. We'll do strawberry rhubarb sorbet, which is really
popular.
Popular. Mm-hmm. And then also like a rhubarb crisp. And we worked with a local sort of famous Instagrammer, Erin Goyoaga, to create a flavor 2 years ago that was really incredible with a buckwheat crumble and rhubarb in a sort of plain ice cream base. Mm.
Lois, what about this? Matt suggests cannabis infused insert flavor here. You are in the U District.
Yes. And we looked into it, but cannabis has to be shelf stable.
Okay.
An edible cannabis has to be shelf stable. You can't be refrigerated. It can't be frozen. So not yet.
Well, I could give you some tips on how to make that. I haven't made it at Molly Min's, but I have made it.
But at home?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How's that go over?
I served it after a Thanksgiving several years ago, and it was a pretty big hit. The party got even more fun.
How about Marissa suggesting impeach mint? Okay, peach, mint. Do you ever get political or, you know, social with your flavors?
We have gotten very political, and I like to call our whole company Social Justice Ice Cream. I created Baraki Road in 2008.
Uh-huh.
That was a huge seller. We sold it again in 2012 for a couple months before the election. And actually, this most popular flavor, our cookie dough, is based on the Clinton cookie recipe, and we called it Hillary Rodham cookie dough all summer last year.
Uh-huh.
I had a lot of those.
Yeah?
The Baraki Road at your shop.
Oh, okay.
Are you going to get involved in the mayoral race with Carrie Moon running for mayor? You can stay way away from that.
Because her last name is Moon?
They have a very similar, it's the same. The eclipse is coming as well. Are you going to take advantage of the eclipse?
No, I'll actually be in New York City during the eclipse. I don't think I'll see it.
Do you hate moon references?
No, not at all. Okay. I love them. And I
apologize.
My middle name is Moon. My parents were hippies, and I gave my daughter a middle name of Moon. So I love it.
It's by choice.
I think the mayoral race this year is really interesting. And I think we have two really fantastic women, really three fantastic women who were in the running. And we would be lucky to have any of them.
Talking with two women who own successful businesses in Seattle, and by the way, they're delicious as well. Sweet Alchemy in the U District, Lois Coe is with me, and Molly Moon, you have how many locations?
Eight.
Eight locations. On KOW's Facebook page, Sonia says, pumpkin maple with honey smoked bacon. There was a time when bacon was all over the place. Does it work in ice cream?
It becomes kind of lard-like, I've noticed. We have to bake it into a crisp or make it some other dessert to put it into the ice cream. I've made it for my friends and family before, but I haven't figured out a way to make it translate that bigger into a commercial environment. Have you?
Yeah, I have a book that came out in 2012 that has most of my most popular recipes of the first 5 years of the company, and our maple bacon ice cream is in there. Mm-hmm. So what we do is lay bacon out on a sheet pan and caramelize it in the oven in brown sugar until it's crispy. Then we chop it up into pieces and sprinkle that into our maple ice cream. And I think that the bacon trend is sort of over. So we did it like 3 or 4 winters, and it was popular. But the last winter we did it, it was really waning. And so I decided, okay, you know, this is over. Let's move on.
Yeah, it's played out.
Yeah.
It was played out a while ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about Lynette says brown sugar pork belly? Same idea?
Yeah, I think that's also over.
Okay, done. Sorry, Lynette. Mandy, though, says, this is interesting. Mandy says chocolate chip, because I challenge you to find it in any store or ice cream shop. I dare you. So this is like the idea that are stores getting away from basic flavors that were working just fine? We loved them. And now, is that true? You can't find chocolate chip?
I would hesitate to put just a chocolate chip on the menu because I don't think it would sell well. Like, vanilla is not in our top 5 flavors. Mm. We carry it because you sort of have to.
Is that right? You're Molly Moon. You could do anything you want, but you feel like you've got to carry vanilla ice cream.
I feel like every ice cream shop needs chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. What do you think, Lois?
Well, for a while, we haven't been carrying our vanilla because we sourced 3 different vanillas from 3 different countries to make our unique blend that we make, and people love it. It sells better than salted caramel. But it's been really hard to source vanilla, and not you guys, but KOW has done a segment about vanilla beans being hard to source. So we're
expensive?
Quadrupled in price in the last year.
Yeah, and even now it's projected to go up higher. And I can't even find the type of vanilla, no matter what price it is. Like, we use Mexican, Madagascan, and Tahitian. And Mexican vanilla has become the hardest to find. And so we're kind of holding back on our vanilla. But I feel like stracciatella has taken off, which is an Italian version. It is chocolate chip ice cream. It's just made slightly different, but has a similar flavor profile.
And a fancier name.
And a fancier name.
People are going to come to a fancy ice cream shop. They're going to want chocolate chip, right?
Yeah. Stracciatella, I feel like, will replace anyone's heart, you know, who's a true chocolate chip fan. Hmm. And it is true, like, when I was a Häagen-Dazs, there was that we had followings, dedicated followings for the vanilla chocolate chip ice cream. We haven't recreated that, but once the vanilla market becomes a little more loose, we might want to experiment
more. It's just gotten
crazy.
When I started my company, I think I was buying a gallon of organic vanilla for like $80, and now it's $417.
Hmm. How about this? Isolde, my colleague, says that in a David Sedaris book of essays, there's a passing reference to camembert ice cream. I'm getting blank stares.
No,
camembert. Not happening.
I mean, that is a great cheese, but don't put it in ice cream.
Okay. There's a flavor you will not get at Molly Moon's, and you won't get it at Sweet Alchemy either.
There's one flavor that my employee has been pushing for me to make for so long, and I'm like, no, that's not going to happen. It's dill pickle ice cream.
Not dill pickle ice cream, not at Sweet Alchemy.
And she's listening to this right now, and I'm sure she's having a ball of me mm-hmm. mentioning this, but I just can't wrap my head around. Do you? Can you?
You know what? Our time is up. We must go. Will you promise now on KOW to dedicate a percentage of the profits from every cone sold this month to finding a cure for brain freeze? Can I sign you up?
I just read this article in the New York Times about how brain freeze cures migraine headaches, which I suffer from. So I'm all pro brain freeze now.
Maybe we can find out and tweet that out, that New York Times article.
That's
brain
great.
Freeze.
Migraine.
Cures migraines. That seems counterintuitive,
right?
Molly Moon.
I'm going to try it the next headache I get.
Molly Moon with, you know her ice cream stores, 8 locations in Seattle, and Lois Coe from Sweet Alchemy on the Ave in the U District. Best subject in the world. Will you come back again?
Of course.
Love
okay,
to.
Great. Come back in the wintertime.
All right.